possible. Okay, so in fact, there was a little bit of arm twisting in this, reason for it is the following. So our lab studies signaling, and we're interested in quantitatively understanding signaling. And it turns out that at this day and age, that at least in my opinion, there are two sort of really fundamental problems that are really structural biology problems that I think are the sort of main things that we have to address at this point in order to move forward in this whole business of signal transduction. And what I mean by that is this. So in the last 30 years or so, people have done a wonderful job of collecting a parts list of all the components. This is a bit like preaching to the choir here, but the essence of it is that the collection of this part list has been extremely important. And the basic paradigm of a paper in signaling would be to find a protein that's involved in the process, genetically manipulated or pharmacologically manipulated with assays that range widely, and then try to understand the role of the single component. In this signaling system, in the fly photoreceptor cell, this is a very advanced state because essentially every one of the components involved in the visual system has been cloned and sequenced and studied to some extent. Knockout mutants exist of essentially every one of the signaling components that are involved here.
This is in the early stage in the photoreceptor cells.
What does it mean later stage or earlier stage? You mean like, I just mean in the visual transduction system has been completely delineated in terms of parts.
Inside the cell, but not all the way up to...
brain. No, just the primary sensory neuron, okay? But a lot of connectivity is known about the rest of it, but in terms of molecular stuff, yeah. So that's the status of affairs, but the fact is that we have not been able to explain the core functional properties of these cells with all that knowledge. And actually, it's been quite good, the work has been done so far. So the principle in the lab is there are two problems to be solved. The first is to understand how this collection of proteins is structurally organized in the light-sensitive membrane, the organelle that I'll describe to you in a moment, that mediates visual signaling, because that order of the proteins and sub compartments, sort of 10 angstrom resolution or 10 nanometer resolution, if you could have it, that would be a description that we need at this point to be able to understand the system better, and I'll show you what I mean by that. But the second problem is a much more kind of basic problem, and that is to say, we collect protein structures, but just looking at protein structures, we don't see how long-range signaling events occur, how the ligand binding pocket at one side talks to the effector interaction surface at a distance. And that's the second problem that's fundamentally important to understand in signaling long-range allostery in proteins. And that's really the stuff the lab works on most right now. However, this system is the one that at least a third of the lab still works on to try to understand this process of putting together components into the signaling networks. So what I'm going to do today is basically this. Start off with, this system is not going to be familiar to most of you, I think, so I'm going to give a quick review of the anatomy and biochemistry and physiology of the system, just that which is required to understand the two other parts of the talk. And I'm going to try, and this may not be possible in the hour that we have, but if it's not, then we'll just quit when we're done. But I'm going to try to tell you two stories. One is about the role of calcium microdomains, and I mean localized parts of the membrane that respond to calcium in a very specific way. And this is an organizing principle for photoreceptor signaling. So feedback regulation of signaling is mediated by this. And I'm going to try to tell you about this and about a particular scaffolding complex called ENA-D that does this job. And then I'm going to tell you, if there's time, about a signaling mechanism that is not the normal one we think of in photoreceptor signaling. We normally think of the process that mediates the opening of ion channels in response to light. Turns out the photoreceptors do another thing too with the light signal, and that is they control their survival, whether they live or die, is a process that's regulated by light as well. And in the last 2 years, actually, there's been a substantial amount of progress in understanding the molecular biology of how light is controlling cell survival decisions as well at a completely different time scale, right? At a time scale of days rather than the time scale of milliseconds, but all initiated by rhodopsin. So I'll try to tell you about that. Okay. So I've already talked about this. Well, why the system? Because we have all the components and all the knockouts, and we have a lot of beautiful assays that you'll see in by way of the talk today. And the questions that demand explanation, well, let's look at the behavior of the system. So let me just say one thing before we go on. Many of you are familiar with the vertebrate photoreceptor cell, the vertebrate rod. Let me just say how vertebrate and invertebrate, or in this case, particularly the fly, photoreceptors are similar and are different. They're similar in some of the components. All the early steps in signaling, rhodopsin, G proteins, arrestin molecules that shut off the receptor are all shared components. Some functional properties, or many functional properties, are shared. For example, this system also shows remarkable amplification of signals in dark adapted conditions, which means that they can respond really to single photons of light with significant electrical responses, so-called single photon response. But they can also, they have a volume knob, they can control the gain of the signaling machinery in a process called adaptation, so that they can remain sensitive over something like 7 log orders of light intensity. They use calcium to mediate that whole adaptation business, and they show light-dependent apoptosis. These are the things that they share. But they're different in some very...
Vertebrates have light-dependent apoptosis?
Yes. Yeah, and I'm going to show you that. We've studied this, and we know and that what's interesting is not just the invertebrate, but that same process is actually a process borrowed from mammalian apoptosis as well. So you'll see. It is amazing, actually. So the differences, though, are many of the components are different. Everything downstream of the G protein is actually a different molecular mechanism, the invertebrate, and you'll see. The electrical output is reversed. Vertebrate photoreceptors, as you probably know, have a dark current, and they hyperpolarize in response to light by closing these non-selective cation channels. But in fact, invertebrates are the opposite. They maintain a hyperpolarized state in the dark, and they depolarize in response to light by opening these non-selective cation channels. The time scale of response. This signaling system, even though it's also a G-protein-mediated signaling process, operates on a time scale which is 10 times faster than the vertebrate rod. So the electrical response comes and goes within about 100 milliseconds, or faster if you increase the calcium concentration. And the anatomy is quite different. The vertebrate rod, as you probably know, is a ciliary structure, a single cilium inside of which there are free-floating discs that contain all the visual signaling apparatus. These photoreceptors are microvillar photoreceptors, you'll see the anatomy of that. It's quite different, actually. So here's the eye, the compound eye of Drosophila. This thing is a collection of 800 or so unit eyes. Each unit eye is called an ommatidium. And you'll see the structure of one of them in a second, but each one has its own lens and a number of photoreceptor cells, really an optically isolated unit. This is just to point out that the purpose of the eye is to take photons, flux from the outside, and convert these into an electrical response that is the input to downstream processing centers in the brain. So flash of light at t equals zero, here's the time bar, 200 milliseconds is this bar, this is a 1 nanoamp current, this is a electrical response measured in a dissociated photoreceptor cell under so-called voltage clamp conditions, and I'll explain all that stuff in a little bit. But a flash of light gives you a fast opening of ion channels and a fast shutoff. The whole thing comes and goes in about 100 milliseconds. I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
Are there many wavelengths detected?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's the next slide, so wonderful. So if you look at the compound eye, if we take one ommatidium and we look at it, now we're looking here, essentially this is a coronal view, this is a transverse view looking. So in other words, the outside is up there, light comes in this way, and here's the axons going off to the brain, right? This ommatidium is a very remarkable structure. It basically contains 20 cells, right? A number of them are support cells, pigment cells, that are there to optically isolate every unit eye from each other. So scattered light doesn't cause activation going the wrong way, if you will. So there's pigment cells that optically isolate every unit eye. There are cone cells that secrete a lens, essentially, on the top that focuses the light. Light is focused into a central canal, a fluid-filled canal, right down in the middle, into which each of the photoreceptor cells extends a stack of membranes, a microvillar stack, so that if you took a section of this thing like this and looked down it, it would look like this, you see? Pigment cells on the outside. There are 8 photoreceptor neurons, 6 of them are called R1 through R6 and are functionally identical, okay? They're the major class of photoreceptors. The R1 through R6 cells extend their microvillar stack of membranes into the central canal, and this microvillar stack is a site of visual transduction. That's where all the machinery is. All of these cells express the same rhodopsin, so they're sensitive to blue. But the R7 and R8 cells are different. These last two cells, they have different two ways. First of all, each cell only goes halfway down the omentidium, right? Whereas these cells have membranes that they're like long, thin cells. They extend from the top to the bottom of the eye. These cells only go halfway, and their light-sensitive membranes are stacked directly on top of each other, okay? And they express two different classes of ultraviolet-sensitive rhodopsins. They're sensitive in the UV, not in the blue. That's the total, kinds of rhodopsins that are, at least in the compound eye. So if I pick a section here, I would see the R7 cell. If I pick a section here, I would see the R8 cell, you see? Okay? So,
R8 cell, it looks like that's the one that has the axon?
No, they both send their axons through. This is, cell bodies are all peripheral, and these light-sensitive membranes are in the center. They all send their axons through the basement membrane here.
So there are eight axons?
There are eight axons going through. Yeah, okay. But six of them are essentially considered functionally identical. They are R1 through R6 cells. They have all the same components, everything the same. R7 and R8 are different. And in fact, behaviorally, they're different. R1 through R6 cells are the ones that mediate all phototaxis in the fly. R7 and R8 are there for funny reasons, and we'll talk about later, for mating response, for detecting the horizon where a lot of scattered light comes, that's the ultraviolet light. So there's an interesting roles for R7 and R8 cells, but genetically you can show the R1 through R6 cells are necessary and sufficient to mediate all the phototactic behavior. Now this eye has terrible visual acuity. It's not like our eye where we have very fine, you can see things very nicely. The fly has a visual acuity which is at maximum related to the intraomatidial angle. That's the minimum angle that they can actually resolve in terms of spatial resolution. But they are exquisite motion detectors, right? So you pass an object over the surface of the eye, and the brain responds to that as motion. And there are motion-sensitive cells in the brain that respond to a pattern put on the eye going this way as opposed to this way, etc. So this is a...
Does that also mean with their fly?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's very interesting. So there's two kinds of processing centers in the brain of the fly. One that mediates large field motion, which is what they use for flight guidance and all this. But they also have a separate nucleus in the brain that is a tracking nucleus that tracks objects in an otherwise moving large field. Yeah, it's really a beautiful system. Okay, what is the signaling mechanism that happens inside of these? So by the way, these light-sensitive membranes, this microvillar stack, is called the rhabdomere, like the outer segment in the rod photoreceptor. This is called the rhabdomere. Okay, what is the signaling setup? This is a standard GQ-mediated phospho-IPC signaling apparatus, okay? Rhodopsin, the G-protein coupled receptor, absorbs a photon of light at 480 nanometers, which is blue. It makes a conformational change to the active state metarhodopsin. This state can now activate a heterotrimeric G-protein of the GQ class, making the active state of the alpha subunit GQ-alpha GTP. We don't know what the role of beta-gamma is just yet in the signaling system, if any of you know about G-protein signaling. Both of these have been now known to initiate downstream signals. Anyway, this thing activates a type 2 or phospho-IPC beta, makes it go to the active state, okay? By the way, all the proteins are labeled like this. The genes encoding those proteins are in the these little brackets. So this is the NORPA gene that encodes the PLC beta.
And which are membrane bound these?
Well, actually, in this system, it's arguable whether there is any cytoplasm out there, okay? But the bottom line is that the integral membrane proteins, the channels, the rhodopsin molecule, and some of the components involved in regeneration of the phospholipids. Everything else is a peripheral membrane protein, essentially. You might argue that PLC beta is soluble until it binds to the G protein and the receptor complex. I have my doubts. I have a feeling that everything is tethered. You'll see why in a moment. So that's the actually important point. Everything is ordered on this membrane, okay? And we're gonna get to that right now. So PLC beta, like it does in every other system, breaks down the minor membrane phospholipid, phosphatidyl inositol, bisphosphate, into the well-known second messengers, inositol, trisphosphate, and diacyl glycerol. This is a kind of a dashed arrow because there's still a lot of controversy about exactly how these ion channels get opened in response to having this reaction. We know that this reaction is absolutely necessary because deletion of this gene by making the NORPA mutant. NORP stands for no receptor potential. Why? Because you mutate that gene and there isn't any light response. The fly is completely blind, okay? So this is an essential reaction. But what actually activates channels? Well, we now, the best hypothesis right now is that it's diacylglycerol or its metabolites, right, that ultimately open these ion channels. But anyway, suffice to say that this reaction opens these ion channels. There are two classes of ion channels, one called TRP, a member of a very big family now, which is a channel which is permeable to both sodium and calcium, but really likes calcium by like 100-fold over sodium. Okay, so this thing actually, there's a significant calcium flux coming through TRP. TRP-like is like TRP, except for the fact that it is mostly a sodium channel, and it has really kind of equal preference for calcium and sodium. But you know, on the outside of these cells, there's 120 times as much sodium as there is calcium. So all the flux going through this thing is essentially sodium, and a majority of this flux going through here is sodium, but a significant amount of calcium goes through as well. This calcium is key. It's the thing that mediates, I'm going to show you in a moment, a sequential positive and negative feedback regulation of the signaling, and that's essential for making the light response. Okay, let me make one point though about this. This thing, the way we draw it, like this signaling cascade, it's a total lie, right? The things don't look like this. In the cell biology, the organization of components is of fundamental importance. And let me show you how things are organized in the cell. So here's actually, I'll show you in a moment. So the first thing I did as a graduate student actually was to figure out a way how to take the adult of eye and get out the photoreceptor cells. So there's in the right magical solution with the right manipulation, you can get one ometidium worth of photoreceptors to come out in clusters, stripped away from all their support cells and pigment cells. So here is a bundle of 8 photoreceptor cells that represents one of these ometidia taken out of the eye, okay? And it's a nuclear stain. You can see the nuclei of these things are, this is the R1 through R6 nuclei. Here's the R7 nucleus, here's the R8 nucleus. Anyway, that was an important step because I'm going to show you that we can do electrophysiology on these things. But what do these cells, these things look like? You see, they look like toothbrushes, actually, right? They're long and skinny. They're about 5 microns wide. They're about 80 microns long. And from one end, here comes the axon going to the brain. And from one side, they have this stack of very tightly packed microvilli. So if I blow up the little microvilli, they look like this. Now, if I blow up one, hypothetically, if I imagine the way that this thing looks is like this. It's really almost a two-dimensional crystal of rhodopsin molecules. This thing is an antenna for light, right? And we know the quantum efficiency of collecting photons through the stack is essentially 1. Right? So the thing is capable of collecting nearly every photon that comes through. The way it does it is that it has essentially a packed array of these receptor molecules interrupted by a lesser fraction of the other signaling components. G proteins, we'll talk about what arrestin is in a moment, phospho-IPC beta, these channels, and I'll show you in a little bit that there's a scaffolding protein that puts some of these things together. But here's the architecture. So let me tell you, very important, right? So. The rhabdomere from here to the tip varies, but it's basically 1 to 1.5 micrometers, okay? The 1 microvillus in distance, so imagine it being a cylindrical rod, okay? So the diameter of the thing is about 50 nanometers, okay? So when you think about the components, you have to think about this being like a gel inside there, right? These one receptor molecule. I mean, if I make a quick calculation, I say one receptor with a 40 kilodalton arrestin molecule inside there, and on the opposing face, another receptor with an arrestin molecule, they're not very far from each other, okay? And there's a single molecule of F actin that runs down the middle of all this. There's a motor protein that shuttles components up and down the microvillar assembly, okay? So there's a really fancy thing going on in here, and so.
Sorry, are there green lines of 2 bimolecular lipid layers?
Correct. Okay. And there is a little space in between them, okay? I'll show you later on, okay? But there's a little space in between them where fluid can come down because remember the ion channels are fluxing ions across this membrane, okay? So just as a real picture of it, how it looks, how dense this thing is, if I do a cross-section, I showed you a cartoon a couple of slides ago, here's a real EM, transverse EM picture, a transmission EM picture of cutting through one step. Each one of these things is a rhabdomere. You see, for the R1 through R6 cells, there's the R7 rhabdomere, and you see the striations, the incredibly tightly packed bristles, right? That each of which is one microvillus that contains all the visual signaling apparatus. Do you guys see what's going on here? Here's the cell body of the cell out here. Here is the rhabdomere.
Okay.
Here are these microvilli are up and down like this. So just to make this really clear, so you see we're cutting like this, and this is looking down, and then here is the rhabdomere. So here is the membrane stack right here.
And there is something actually holding them together, but the outside edge looks too small. Right.
What do you mean? They're holding them here?
Right.
Well, there are these proteins that actually are bridging the organizational components of the rhabdomere that we're just beginning to learn about. There are proteins that dimerize across the lipid bilayers that hold the whole thing together. We don't know a lot about that actually, but.
The
eye completely, because I can do experiments from them, I can take these cells and I can record from them and switch the external conditions and immediately see the changes in the conductance of the channels. So there's no, it's diffusion limited process. It's incredible actually, right, the system. All right, so anyway, what we learned a long time ago, the assay I set up as a grad student was how to make these cells, and then I could take a fire polished glass electrode connected to an amplifier, right, with an electrolyte solution and an intracellular solution, and I can bring it to the surface of one of these cells, and I can make a very high resistance seal on the membrane. Okay, the seal is on the order of gigaohms, right? So that's the so-called cell attached mode of patch clamp analysis, where what I can do then is, if underneath that little bit of membrane there was one ion channel or something, I could record the flux of ions across that bit of membrane through that ion channel. But I can do another thing, and that is that while I'm in the cell attached mode of patch clamp and I'm on the cell, I can either by supplying a large pulse of electricity or by sucking physically back on the electrode, break that little bit of membrane underneath my pipette, and I can go into so-called whole cell mode of patch clamp, where I'm now physically and electrically communicating with the entire inside of the cell. And so here's a fluorescein fill showing you that I can specifically fill one cell out of that 8-cell cluster in this whole cell recording. And in this mode, with beautiful time and resolution and signal to noise, record the electrical activity of the cells.
What sort of cells, channels live?
On the outside? Voltage-gated potassium channels. Yeah. And it's a very beautiful work that's recently out that shows that the role of those potassium channels in a really interesting way is to modulate they dynamically modulate the impedance of the photoreceptor membrane and are actually involved in shaping the electrical current. But for our purpose, we're going to ignore them completely because we're going to voltage clamp the cells and none of those channels are ever open because we're going to hold the voltage constant.
The basic time scales of the electrical activity, are those similar to...
No, as I said, it's like 10 times faster, actually.
When you say that, you're talking about rod and low.
Yeah.
Because if you cones, for example, is it comparable to cones?
Yeah, but it's about 5 times faster than cones. Cones are faster than rods, but this system is significantly faster than all of them, actually. If you look at a single photon response, it's quite a bit faster.
I can't understand. All your little processes are stacked.
Yeah.
Why do the bottom ones ever see any light? Aren't they all trapped by the light?
This is a very nice question, actually. So, there's something I haven't told you about the way that the light is conducted in that stack. So the way it works. We may as well do this, right? The way it works is that it turns out the refractive indices of this thing compared to the cell are just so that at the right acceptance angle you get total internal reflection inside of the membrane stack. So photons are extremely efficiently collected at a very narrow viewing angle by the stack of membranes, and very badly collected at angles away from that acceptance angle. Why is that beautiful? Because these cells want to sample normal directions in space, right? Without a lot of, and so the way that the guys at the bottom get photons, presumably, is through total internal reflection inside this membrane stack. And the absorbance almost certainly is much higher on the outside than it is down here. But still, that's the way the system works.
What is the acceptance angle?
Quite narrow, actually. I don't remember. Nicolae Franceschini measured it a long time ago. But it's narrow enough that the cell, each cell, can uniquely sample essentially a direction in space. I mean, without a huge amount of Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's quite quite narrow. But French Chinese measured it. We know the answer. I don't know it right now, though. It's been a long time I thought about this. Anyway, it's a very cool system. Anyway, so we can now record from these things. What is the electrical response? So here is the behaviors that I told you we wanted to explain at this. Yes?
I have a question. How do you record your
battery? Yeah.
How does the circuit go?
The circuit goes like this. Maybe I can just draw it. The circuit goes like this. The cell, let's just draw the cell for a moment as a spherical thing, but you understand that it's not. Okay. So the circuit goes like this. I have voltage pipette. This is connected to an amplifier. There is a resistor here, which is the so-called series resistor. There's a very, very large resistor that goes out to, this is the seal, the resistance of a seal. This is on the order of gigohms, so you can basically ignore it in a whole cell recording. R series is on the order of sort of 10 megohms. And then here you have voltage of the cell. And then across the membrane, there is your conductance. And this is the thing, of course, the cell regulates. That's when it opens ion channels. It changes the resistor across the membrane. And this is in, there's a capacitance of the membrane, and this is out like that. So what we're recording, what we're doing is giving a command potential to hold the cell at a certain voltage. When the cell chooses, so there's a feedback, you see, on keeping the V cell at some constant value, that's a so-called voltage clamp. When the cell decides to change the conductance of the membrane, say by opening ion channels, then we pass a compensatory current through here to keep V cell at a constant. And that is exactly equal to and opposite to the current being generated by the cell. So that's how we measure. That's the whole cell voltage clamp. Okay. So thanks. So the what is the response of these things? So if I take a cell like this under whole cell mode and I turn down the light so low that on average only one photon is being absorbed by the cell, then I get what's called the quantum bump or the single photon response. These are stochastic electrical responses to the absorption of a single photon. That means one receptor molecule got activated. And here's how it looks. You give a flash, and then there's a randomly distributed wait time. It's a Poisson process. A randomly distributed wait time, and then you get a rapid activation, inactivation of channels. You can see the time course of that is on the order of 20, 30 milliseconds, right? And the amplitude you can see on the order of 10 picoamps, 10, 15 picoamps of current, okay? This corresponds to the opening, a concerted opening of about 15 ion channels in response to one photon of light. Those are the numbers, okay? The parameters of the quantum bump the cell can control are the size of the quantum response, the shape of the quantum response, and the probability distribution of getting them. Okay, those are the three. Keep that in mind, because I'm going to tell you that if we can molecularly explain those three quantities, we really understand the system completely, and we have actually only a partial understanding of some of those.
How long is the latency?
The average wait time is about 20 milliseconds. So that's the average time it takes to crank through the signal, whatever the limiting processes is, right? I don't know what that is. I think.
Duration of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a little bit faster than the duration, I would say. 30 milliseconds, maybe, about the duration of the quantum response.
Decoding to the decoding ratio is again 1 in 10 or is it 1 in 10?
No, it's for every. For every 100 rhodopsins, there is one G protein.
So you have to find the G protein.
Correct. So this random wait time could be the two-dimensional diffusion time of an activated receptor to find a G protein. That's probably the likely explanation for it. But we don't know that for a fact. I mean, there are experiments that one could. I mean, for example, if I make GQ hypermorphs, things that have less G protein, then my latency definitely increases, right? Anyway, so. The macro. So let's say I give a flash of light now that does not contain single photons absorptions, but let's say I now give a single delta function that contains 1,000 photons, right? So what does the response look like? Looks like this. What this is actually is just a statistical superposition of all these underlying quantum events, linear combination of all the underlying quantum events. Okay, what does it mean? That means that the shape of this macroscopic response is the average shape and size of a quantum response convolved with the probability distribution of getting it. You see? Yes?
So there's nothing scientifically consistent or
There's no, I'm sorry. No, right. This neuron that produces no action potentials, all graded potentials. Why are you laughing?
No, I'm
talking to Boris. Sorry, I'm sorry.
If I'm looking at the upper sending codon spot?
Yes.
It is only a very small part of the
macroscopic. Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, because this contains 1,000 single photon responses that are statistically independent from each other, right? And are essentially linear summation of all those single photon responses. So mathematically, this thing should be, right? The average waveform there convolved with the probability distribution of getting it, and I'll show you that data right now, actually. So if it's really a Poisson process, so here is the membrane noise in the dark. If I, yes, Boris.
But this linearity doesn't really, the likelihood of two photons hitting the same microvilli is zilch at this flux, right?
Yes.
So
that's why.
Because they're hitting the
absolutely.
Right?
If you
there's no non-linearity, so there is
if
no excitability in the cell, but there may well be excitability in the microvilli.
Certainly. And if you increase the light enough, you deviate from linearity clearly. So you're linear out to about 1,000 photons. You'll see that right now. So here's the noise of the membrane in the recording in the dark. If I now put on a very weak continuous light that just gives me stochastic absorptions of light, I see quantal responses coming and going. You see considerable variability in the amplitude of the quantal response, right, but for each one. But the shape is absolutely canonical, just perfect, right? And if it's a Poisson process, then the wait times in between quantum responses should be randomly distributed or exponentially distributed. So here is plotting number of events against the interval between quantum responses, showing you a very nice exponential fit, right?
What happens in the dark?
You're looking at one cell here.
Yeah. Yeah, in this case, what we're doing is we're just giving a continuous, very low light stimulation that where you just get randomly distributed stochastic absorptions of light, and the wait time in between those should just be a Poisson process, right?
Well, no, I mean, if the photon hits it randomly, and then there's a random latency after the photon hits, that's not a Poisson process.
Like,
there's
lots of
microvilli.
Like the particles keeping themselves intact.
Well, I'm not sure I understand, but yeah, explain it later.
What happens in the dark?
Oh, in the dark, very, very great question. So if I sit there in the dark and I watch the oscilloscope, then once every 2 minutes, a quantal response happens. And you know what that is? That's the thermal rate of converting Levinsys retinal to all-trans retinal.
But this thing, you're saying that
the thing is incredibly quiet.
Dark, yeah. The bumps are.
The dark bumps are the same. Yeah. So when you get a receptorized sunrise, whether by thermal activation or by light, it's the same thing, actually. The quantal response looks the same if you look in the dark. But the dark events are incredibly rare. The membrane's very quiet is the point in the dark, which is also a thing that is demand is something we need to explain, okay? All right, so if I do now a different experiment where I now just give flashes of very, very, very low light flux, then here is now shown a number of traces, a number of records, what I will get is successes some of the time and failures many other times. And that tells you that this is you're at a light level where you're getting all or none responses. Either you're getting them or not getting them. In fact, if you take the latency distribution of getting quantal responses, that means measuring the time between the flash and when the quant bump happened. Here's the latency distribution fit to a log normal. Here's the average bump waveform. Here's the convolution of the two. And there's a superposition of the convolution with the macroscopic current where you're giving them now of 1,000 simultaneous photons. Just showing you that, in fact, you can account for the macroscopic response pretty well by knowing these statistical parameters of the bump.
This is a very short burst of photons, much shorter.
Oh yeah, much, much shorter, yeah. Nanoseconds of light as opposed to, yeah. Yes, so each quantal response is like 15 ion channels. So there's some concerted opening that we don't understand. So that's critical to explain. And just showing you that the current is linear with photons out to about 1,000 photons. So it's in fact, you can say that the system behaves like a linear summation of quantum responses out to 1,000 simultaneous photons. Okay, so now let me show you something that we discovered a long time ago. So it turns out this actually, what we found was, if I take the photoreceptor cell, the ion channels are non-selective cation channels. That means that they pass all monovalence, and given the ionic concentrations that we have, the channel will have zero net current at near zero millivolts. Why? Because roughly equal concentrations of ions on both sides of the membrane, so the so-called reversal potential, or the current, the voltage at which you get zero net current is around zero. So if we hold the cell at minus 80 millivolts, then you'll get inward currents, and the inward currents look like this, these fast activating and inactivating currents. If I now hold the cell at plus 80 millivolts, relative, so the cell is now plus 80 respect to the outside, then I get outward going currents, and you see the outward currents? Completely different in shape, right? Slow. Slow activating, slow shut off. In fact, here's a whole series of traces at minus 80, minus 60, minus 40, minus 20, 0, 20, 40, 60, 80 millivolts, right? And so what the bottom line is, there's a big asymmetry of the shape of the current for inward currents versus outward going currents. And what is that, right? Excuse me?
This is total current.
This is a macroscopic current, total current. So it just tells you that the response, the system behaves differently when currents are flowing inside the cell as opposed to when ions are flowing outside. Now you could also explain this by some, you could say the most likely thing you would think of when you see this is that this is some very fancy voltage dependence of this. The reversal potential is zero because the channels are basically don't care what kind of monovalent ion goes through. Well, no, it's, like I said, it's a non-selective cation channel, so it passes sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium with roughly equal probability, and likes calcium a bit more. But in the conditions of the experiment, the way we set it up, the reversal potential is very close to zero. Okay. All right. So this could be some really fancy voltage dependence. In fact, if you look at instead of a delta function of light, if you give a pulse of light, you get a rather complicated waveform for the inward currents. This is adaptation, okay? Look what's happening. While maintaining a stimulus, the system activates and then inactivates to some steady state value, you see? And then you turn the light off and then it shuts off all back to zero, okay? So this is a very common response for many calcium-mediated signaling processes. But all that stuff is much different on the inward currents and the outward currents. So to make a long story short, this could have been a very fancy voltage dependence. Actually, it turns out to be not at all a voltage dependence. It simply cares about the direction of ion flow. Why? Because when you have inward currents, calcium ions from the outside are going into the cell, right? When you have outward currents, calcium is not going into the cell. In fact, the flux is out of the cell, right? And so we suggested that this whole asymmetry could be explained by the direction of calcium flow. So it turns out experiments are obvious, right? Take out all the calcium on the outside, and now the currents become perfectly symmetric across the reversal potential, no asymmetry. You put in 1 millimolar of calcium out, you can make the inward current go faster. The outward current doesn't do very much, right? You crank up the calcium to 20 millimolar on the outside, you get really fast inward currents, and not much happens to the outward current. So it's very clear, and look at the pulse responses, right? So if you do a pulse at zero calcium, there's no adaptation, nothing, right? The thing just gives you this very slow response. At 1 millimolar calcium, you saw the response already. Look what happens at 20 millimolar external calcium. Both the rate of inactivation and the extent of this adaptation, the extent and rate of adaptation is dependent on the concentration of external calcium.
What is that second bomb?
This thing? Okay, so the system will ring if you give it under the right conditions. You can make it. If I give a very long pulse, it'll do this. I'll get an activation, and then it'll ring a little bit, and then settle down into the thing. And so clearly, this is some dynamics of the system that we don't really understand. Very calcium dependent. Okay, so calcium is this. What this told us was that calcium was a major player in determining the kinetics of the macroscopic response. And actually, Roger Hardy has gone on to show that the point is what is going on during adaptation here. how can you reduce the size of the macroscopic current? Two things could happen. It could be that you're adjusting the bump shape and size, right? So that here you have the same probability of bump generation as you do here, but the size and shape are now different, right? Alternatively, it could be that the size and shape of the bump are exactly the same here, and it's just the probability of getting them which is being changed by the adaptation process.
But does it depend on the calcium concentrations or the calcium currents?
It depends on the calcium current, because if you block the, if I keep the external calcium at 1 millimolar, but I block the calcium conductance, then nothing. Then you don't get any change in the kinetics. The calcium has to come into the cell from the outside.
It could still depend on the concentration of calcium in the cell or on the currents.
No. It's the concentration. It's the intercellular concentration of calcium. I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. So what Roger showed was, in fact, the probability latency distribution of getting quantal responses and the probability of getting quantal responses is really not a function of calcium at all, but the shape and size of the quantal response. So here's a whole family of traces. Here's the quantum bump at zero external calcium. Here's the quantum bump at 50 micromolar calcium. Here's the quantum bump at 100 micromolar calcium, and so on and so forth, all the way up to 1.5 millimolar external calcium. The point is that the shape and size of the quantum bump is very exquisitely sensitive to calcium, but the probability of getting a quantum response and the latency distribution is really not very much calcium, very calcium dependent. So it tells us the bump generator, the thing that makes the bump, the shape is very, very calcium sensitive. So this is what we know so far. Calcium goes through the trip channel. It mediates some sequential positive and negative feedback. Both the rate of opening channels and the rate of shutting them off is faster with calcium. What is the mechanism of this? How do you figure out the mechanism? Well, it turned out that we had 40 mutants in the lab that were defective, in each of them, in individual components of the signaling cascade. We went and screened a bunch of them, okay? So just to remind you of this, here's the response at 1 millimolar external calcium. Here's the response at zero external calcium. But here's a mutant called ENA-C, okay? ENA-C mutants have this very interesting phenotype where the activation rate, calcium-dependent activation rate, was perfectly normal, as in wild type, but you totally wiped out the, or you severely screwed up the inactivation by calcium, right? And so how do I know that this is all calcium dependent? Because if I record from ENA-C mutants at zero external calcium, there's no phenotype. You see what I'm saying? That means that if you don't have calcium on the outside, right, there's no phenotype for ENA-C. In other words, genetically speaking, what we're saying is calcium is epistatic to the ENA-C phenotype. That is, whatever ENA-C is doing, this slow shutoff is a calcium dependent process. So these data really told us that calcium is doing two things, a positive feedback that we don't understand the molecular basis of, but it's doing negative feedback regulation through this protein kinase C. And the protein kinase C isn't apparently doing anything else besides calcium-dependent shutoff, because if you knock out the PKC, when you don't have any calcium on the outside, there's no phenotype that we can reveal anyway, right? So this puts the PKC downstream of calcium. Now, does that make sense? Yes, because PKCs are well known to be calcium-activated protein kinases. What's interesting about PKCs is they're not only calcium-activated, but diacylglycerol-activated. So there was this nice idea that light would come along and generate diacylglycerol, right, which would open ion channels, and the production of diacylglycerol together with influx of calcium mediated this fast shutoff of the response. So sort of stimulus-mediated shutoff of the response. Okay. So let me tell you one thing. Given that calcium is really important in the cell, it seemed really important for us to actually measure the calcium concentration in the cell as a function of light, right? How do we normally measure calcium in cells? Well, we measure it using these fluorescent indicators of calcium, like FURA2, FLO3. Here's an interesting problem, though. How do you do it in photoreceptor cells, right? Here you got a fundamental problem, right? How do you measure calcium using fluorescence methods in cells that are photosensitive, right? This is sort of a thing that had prevented really the study of calcium fluxes in photoreceptor cells for a long time. And because look, here is the spectral sensitivity of the photoreceptor cells as a function of wavelength of light. And you can see they have a very broad sensitivity over much of the visual spectrum, a spectrum which is covered by essentially all of our available calcium indicators, okay? So we can't do the experiment, right? Let me just point out that it's the worst case scenario because the cells have single photon sensitivity and the indicators are generally have bad quantum efficiency, so it's actually the worst case possible, right? So, but there is an interesting way to do it. Let's say you use fly genetics, right? And you made mutants that wiped out the endogenous rhodopsin gene and you put in place, using transgenic methods, an ultraviolet sensitive rhodopsin, right? So here now are transgenic flies called RH1 plus 4, where we've essentially retuned these cells, right, genetically, to be sensitive only in the UV, right, by taking out the endogenous rhodopsin and putting in an ultraviolet rhodopsin.
Now, this is like rhodopsin in the 7A?
Yeah, yeah. We took the RH4 rhodopsin that was in the R7 cell and expressed it behind the promoter of RH1 and made a transgenic fly, and we put it in a background that deleted the endogenous RH1 gene, okay? And so now we've got engineered guys that physiologically in every way behave exactly normally, except they're now tuned in the UV, you see? And now this is cool because we could now use calcium orange, long wavelength calcium indicator, and superimpose a flash of UV light and actually measure the calcium in the cells, right? So fly genetics helps out. Yes.
Do you use microelectrodes?
Yeah, but there's two. I have two problems with that. Calcium sensitive microelectrodes are really hard to make and calibrate, especially when you're working with small cells like this. And you know, I did this work when I was a grad student with Roger Chen, and Roger is an expert at making those things, and he told me to stay away from those things as much as possible. So we stayed away from them. So in fact, this works. Okay, so what's shown here is the black is an electrical. So you know, think about how good this is, though, right? Because we can simultaneously image these cells while also recording for them electrically, right? So we can match up the electrical response with the calcium response. So here is now the black is the electrical response. So first I put on the green light, and the red is the calcium trace. Okay, so if I put on the green light, I actually get a little bit of a response. Why? Because there's a little bit of sensitivity out there in the green. So there's a little response to light, but then I put on the ultraviolet light and bam, I get a big, nice electrical response. Notice the time is much more protracted now than it was. So these are all the same kinetics as before. And associated with that, I get a nice calcium jump. And then I go back to the green light and I watch the kinetics of the calcium come back down. So here's a blow up actually of this little region showing you that green light goes on, calcium goes up a little bit, but then I give an ultraviolet pulse and I get a nice jump in calcium. I can watch the kinetics.
Where was the sort of the second ringing? Was it like a second later or the number?
Yeah, it's right in here actually, right? And so the way that thing looks is very sensitive to calcium and a number of other poorly controlled parameters.
Calcium is back to the original state.
Well, no, the calcium is not back. This is the result of this was that the calcium goes up together with the opening of the ion channels, but it decays at a time constant of the order of several seconds, right? So this is what process is going on here? It's the sodium calcium exchangers pumping out the calcium from the microvilli, okay? Getting rid of the calcium and diffusion into the cell, presumably. Okay, so I just want to say one experiment. Why did we do this whole thing anyway? Because we wanted to test something specific. It turns out that before I show you this trace, let me just make one comment. Most people think of calcium-dependent processes in cells as operating in this sort of 10 resting calcium in cells is typically 10 to 100 nanomolar. Okay, and bulk calcium in cells upon signaling typically elevates to about 1 micromolar, right? Or 2 micromolar, but that's it, right? That's a calcium response, right? But it turns out that there's near the membrane, right? The calcium cannot just go up to 1-2 micromolar, but can spike to hundreds of micromolar because right near the membrane where the ion channels are, right? And so a number of cellular processes are known to depend on these very large transients of calcium right near the membrane. Like, for example, synaptic vesicle excitosis depends on very large amplitude calcium transients right near the vesicles. So we wondered in this microvillar system with this very tightly packed membrane structure, what is the magnitude of calcium which is necessary to drive this PKC-mediated shutoff, right? And or for that matter, the positive feedback. So the experiment we did was we took cells and we dialyzed the cells through the patch pipette itself. So we put in the patch pipette calcium buffers of different strength, if you will, binding calcium, right? And asked how they influence the light response, okay? So if I put in the patch pipette 2 millimolar EGTA...
So the pipette is touching one...
cell. One cell. But I showed you in the fluorescein fill that once I break open the membrane underneath it, I can dialyze the entire cell with my contents of the patch pipette in a matter of 2 minutes. Okay? So we know that to be true. And there's several arguments that say that. Actually, I've just given you one, but the other things too. So... Oh, yeah, yeah. So EGTA is quite slow, actually. It's a quite slow calcium buffer. And I'm just showing you that a very slow calcium buffer, even though it has a quite tight binding constant for calcium, has really no effect on the light response. It looks just like it did before, right? But if I put in 2 millimolar BAPTA, okay? Now, BAPTA has the same dissociation constant for calcium, but it's actually like 100 times faster in its rate of chelating calcium. Then look at, I get profound effects. What I get actually is this, and I'll just summarize what you get. You get a current that, boom, activates hugely and never shuts off actually, right? And the calcium goes up and never comes back down. So this is a picture of positive feedback regulation happening through calcium, but totally wiping out the negative feedback regulation through calcium. So 2 millimolar BAPTA clips the whatever necessary transients to get PKC-mediated shutoff to happen. What was interesting was when we dialyzed a cell with 2 millimolar trans 5, a calcium buffer that has a binding constant on the order of 20 micromolar, you get the same effect as you got with BAPTA. What does it mean, right? It means that the calcium transients that are necessary to get PKC-mediated shutoff are rising in the neighborhood or higher than 20 micromolar, because this buffer would do nothing for fluctuations that are happening at a much, much lower amplitude than this. These are big calcium transients near the membrane. But as a control, I'll just say, I'll put this back on a second, that a buffer that has a much higher dissociation for constant for calcium, like 1 millimolar, has no effect on light response. So now we're above the transients, you see? So the transients of calcium happening near the membrane are somewhere in the tens to hundreds of micromolar range. So in this regard, I wanted to say, so what we're saying is that in the membrane, this calcium-mediated positive feedback is apparently kind of a low amplitude calcium business. It doesn't need very high amplitude calcium at all. But the PKC-mediated shutoff requires high amplitude calcium. Then it was really interesting, actually. So we said in that paper, by the way, that there must be some mechanism to put the PKC in some neighborhood, right, of where these calcium transients, calcium is happening, because where in the cell is calcium going to become hundreds of micromolar? It's sort of in the vicinity of these calcium channels, in the near to the physically where these calcium channels actually are. So it was really cool when it was discovered in 1996 that there was a scaffolding protein called ENA-D, right? And what ENA-D did was that it bound the TRP calcium channel, it bound the protein kinase C that was mediating the negative feedback regulation, and it bound the excitatory molecule PLC beta that turns on the whole system, right? Isn't that interesting, right? So here we've got this little complex, right, of proteins that one is just what we predicted from that original work that was mediating some sort of, presumably there to mediate localized calcium signaling. But let me give you one experiment that really illustrates that this localization of the channel to this complex is actually really important in the negative feedback regulation. So what is ENA-D? ENA-D is it's one of these molecular Velcro things, right? It's a protein that contains 5 PDZ domains. PDZ domains are little modules that bind to target proteins and involved in localizing them, right? Each PDZ domain appears to bind a different target in the signaling system. So PDZ3 binds TRP, PDZ4 binds the PKC, and 5 binds the PLC beta. All I want to say in here is there's an interesting point mutation we have that already existed in the fly called ENA-D215. And 215 is a point mutation in PDZ3 that totally abrogates its binding to the ion channel. So what's the prediction here, right? The ENERD215 mutant, even though all the components are physically there in the microvilli, right? In that mutant, the ENERD complex is going to be physically dissociated from the ion channel. And if that localization of the channel to the complex was actually important, then we should see a phenotype that looks a lot like the PKC mutant, right? In the mutant where the channel is mislocalized. So in fact, what you find is, yeah, wild type has that shape, and the ENERD 215 mutant, right? Remember, this is a mutant in which none of the proteins are missing or something, right? It's just mislocalization of the ion channel relative to the rest of the complex. You get a phenotype that beautifully phenocopies the PKC mutant, actually, right? It looks just like that. So what are we saying? If you don't have the channel near the complex, you may as well not have the PKC there at all, right? So in fact, quantitatively, if you look, you can show that just like the PKC mutant, if you look at the rate of shutoff of the response, at zero external calcium, there's no phenotype. But at 1 millimolar calcium, wild type inactivates very rapidly, while ENERD 215 inactivates much more slowly, just in a pattern that looks just like the PKC mutant. Yeah?
But wouldn't we also predict that the on time will be slower? Because
no, because the positive feedback business through calcium is not mediated by ENERD. That's a low amplitude calcium.
But I thought this PLC is also sitting on.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So PLC beta is sitting there on the complex, presumably involved in activating the system, but the calcium-dependent positive feedback, the site of that, we don't know, right? All we can say is it's not dependent on this complex because it happens just as well in the ENERD mutants as it does in
before we get the positive calcium feedback, we've got to activate the channel.
So the PLC beta activates the ion channels, but how that happens, we don't know exactly, right? We know that PLC enzymatic activity is necessary for getting the channels to open, but it doesn't explain how we get 15 ion channels synchronously open in response to a.
So it is acting via some lipid.
It's making an activator in the membrane, but you realize it must be activating many ENERD complexes because every ENERD complex has an ion channel associated with it, right? So somehow imagine the process. One PLC beta gets activated, it then activates a little field of ENERD scaffolding complexes, right? And but the feedback regulation is. It requires the micro localization of all these components in a little complex.
But the ENERD complex is supposed to be connected together.
Excuse me?
But the ENERD complex is connected together.
No, there's no evidence yet, although they could, but I don't think so. I think the ENERD complex is. So it's interesting. It turns out the number of ENERD complexes there is in one microvillus is about the number of ion channels that are open during a quantal response. So there may be this nice idea that one microvillus firing, right, is one quantal response, right? At least in the for dark adapted cells, that's a hypothesis. We need to somehow check that.
But yeah. The amplitude variation presumably
amounts to the way in which you fill microvilli with excitatory components, and that presumably that's not an equal process. Every microvillus is an individual in terms of what it can do. There's a very beautiful experiment that argues that. There's a mutant that we found in the fly that has the following property. Instead of giving you one quantal response, what you get in this mutant is a quantal train of responses. In other words, what you get is, instead of getting one quantal response and then being shut off, in this mutant you get this, like that, you see? And what's quantal is the train. In other words, you either get a train or you do not get a train, right? And what's really interesting is that the variance, amplitude variance, within a train is much, much less, in fact, almost not at all, compared to the amplitude variance between trains. So it's like you're firing the same microvillus again and again, right, in this funny mutant. And so that's a really nice argument that, you know, some unit, which is maybe the microvillus, you know, that's a weak argument, but some canonical physical property of this local part of the membrane is the quantal response. But we need to understand that.
But how many of these complexes are there in one?
Microvillus. The other thing, I think it's about the same number as there are ion channels. It's about 15 to 20 per microvillus. But that number comes from so these rough calculations where you count up the number of microvilli and you quantitate on quantitative Westerns the amount of protein and figure out how much there must be. So it's pretty wimpy, okay? Is there, excuse me?
Intracellular.
Oh, there's no intracellular calcium release that we've ever detected. And there's been a lot of studies done on that. There's no role. Even though IP3 is being made, you would think that you'd be dumping calcium from the internal stores. I can use pharmacologic agents that dump all the internal calcium stores. The light response could care less. Right. But may become dynamic. There's some evidence recently we've got in labs. In the lab, we're working on crystal structure of the Enity complex, and we've got a part of the thing done now, right? And it turns out that one of the PDZ domains shows dynamical conformational changes in response to the history of light, and that's a really interesting observation. There may be some dynamics there.
When you say
No, it's there. No. Actually, it's a very important result. If you look at by antibody staining on the membrane, the TRP is there. It's in the rhabdomere. It's just not localized to the thing. So it's not that it's gone. It's there.
But it may not be with the complex.
It's not with the complex, exactly. It's now free floating on the membrane, you know, randomly associated with. Yeah.
The mutant that keeps on making bumps
is a chemodulin mutant, actually. It's a mutant of chemodulin. Calcium is
some mutants where rhodopsin does not inactivate.
Yes, and those give you like arrested mutants, and they give you the same phenotype as well.
The
ENC double mutants have no phenotype that's not explained by just each of the single mutants. So it's what you expect, right? So the mislocalization. Yeah. It is, totally. So if you make ENIS-C knockout on the background of Unity 215, you don't get any added phenotype. Yeah. So it looks really good, that's the idea. But think of what it means. I mean, to me, it's amazing, actually, because I mean, I imagine what's going on. I mean, to me, this microvillus, let's just think for a loud about the dimensions of things, right? We're talking about a micron and a half long, 50 nanometers wide. Oh, what kind of volume in there? There's like nothing in there, right? And when these ion channels open, I just cannot believe that the entire microvillus doesn't just fill up with calcium, right? And how could you make, I mean, the implication in here is there are spatial gradients of calcium, right, within the microvillus. So you get local regulation around the ion channel in some way. I don't know what the shape of the, I'm certain that the shape of the calcium here is going to depend incredibly on two things. The geometry of the system, right? I mean, you can just see that from the proximity of these two parts of the microvillus. But on the location of all these sodium-calcium exchangers, they're going to be pumping out the calcium like crazy, and they will be critical in shaping the gradient of calcium. So here's what we wanted to do. We wanted to directly measure the gradient of calcium on these membranes. How are we going to do that, right? So the idea was, so let me just summarize what I told you. So calcium influx drives positive and negative feedback. Negative feedback operates through PKC and requires large amplitude calcium fluxes. And now we know that Enity scaffolds all this stuff, okay? here's what we're trying to do, right? You know there's these GFP-based calcium indicators called CamGuru and all this, right? These are GFPs that were sensitive to concentration of calcium. Imagine making transgenic flies where you fuse CamGuru to like a lot of the components of the signaling system individually, right? The idea is, can you sample the calcium in the vicinity, right, of the different molecules, right? But if the gradient of calcium idea is correct, then there should be a different concentration of calcium if I put ENID on arrestin, which is samples average membrane calcium, right? So arrestin, this molecule that involved in shutting off the receptor, if I hang a light bulb off the thing, right? If I put a GFP calcium indicator there, it's gonna sample the average membrane calcium. If I now move it to the scaffold, would I actually see, you know, higher steady state levels of calcium, right? Well, that's the experiment that's being done. Let me just tell you the results we have so far are that, in fact, we've made transgenic flies making GFP or CamGuru arrestin. If you look in the photoreceptor cells, you see beautifully the rhabdomeres, the microvilli are lit up in response to just exciting the calcium, the GFP. This is a cell under conditions of 1 millimolar external calcium. This is a cell with zero external calcium, right? So in fact, we see the fluorescence intensity of the rhabdomeric bundle is significantly higher in when there's external calcium, and much lower when there's not external calcium. So the indicator, I think, is working, and there's a bunch of controls here we have to do to calibrate the indicator for so we can read actually concentration of calcium from the fluorescence, which is the stuff that's going on right now. We've made transgenic flies that express that are C-terminal and N-terminal fusions to ENA-D. We've also fused Camgaroo to the TRP ion channel directly. Okay, all these flies are essentially ready now, but have not been studied yet. So that's the next thing to do, right? So we hope soon, like in the matter of 6 months or so, to have some numbers, right, for what is the in the dark and in the light. So we're not going to get kinetic. The whole point of the experiment is not to get kinetics as a function of flashing light and looking at the calcium concentration as a function of time. We're not going to get that kind of information. What we are going to get is, what is the steady state concentration of calcium in the vicinity of several proteins in the dark versus in the light upon excitation, okay? And now here's a challenge for all of us, right? Can we take that data and the geometry of the system and the numbers that I've told you, other things that I haven't told you, can we now come up with a quantitative model that would describe, right, the spatial distribution of calcium and how that's controlled by the cell, and use that model to make some sort of a prediction that we could go test, right? It should be possible. Boris and I have been talking about this. So I think that the time is ready now, given that we what we know so far, to make presumptively some kind of a quantitative theory for the spatial distribution of calcium in response to just two conditions, dark versus light. Presumably in dark, there's no gradient. In the light, there will be a gradient of calcium, and we want to be able to see that.
The diffusion times are much faster than the time scales that you're in.
The what is faster?
The diffusion time would be...
Diffusion time,
one of these processes in the next.
Oh, yeah.
Faster than the time scale just in the response. But then you think that the intrinsic response is much faster, but you're only seeing it because you're looking at the cell body rather than the...
Well, no, we're looking at the rhabdomere, but I mean, the point is that the diffusion time. I mean, who knows what it is in this system? But I think it is probably quite a bit very fast, right? It's likely to be very fast relative to the time course of the electrical response, right? But if you look at steady state, right, where now you're tonically exciting the cell, right? Under those conditions, what is this spatial gradient look like? I don't want to see the time dependence of that gradient.
Okay, right.
I just want to know what it looks like, right? At steady state, and we know that we can get good numbers for those two. I'm not confident that we're going to get any dynamics of that gradient because I'm worried about the speed at which this Camgaroo can deal with calcium and all this stuff. But I know that the steady state numbers, I think we can get.
So are there other calcium binding proteins that sort of serve as endogenous buffers in the
yes, there. Yes, but there almost certainly are. The F-actin actually is probably a big store of calcium right there. But there's a ton of chemodulin, and there are definitely both fixed and mobile calcium buffers in the system, I think. How much will we have to know about those? I mean, the thing to do is to start the process of making a quantitative theory and see how bad it is at predicting the numbers we get out from the experiment, right? And try to move forward from there. So anyway, okay. So we've come to the end of this point. At this point, I know that it's getting late. So if you guys want to stop, we can stop. There's this really gorgeous story on the apoptosis, but I think in the interest of time, we may want to do this at another time or something. I don't know. We don't have to do it. I mean, but I would do it. It's a fun story. It's a really nice story. But anytime you want, I'll do it. I'm just here today, so. I mean, the whole story can be told in 15 minutes if it had to be. But it's up to you guys, though. Do it at 2? Okay, let's do it later then. It's fine. I don't care.
Maybe one. Okay. Let's do it.
Fine. We will. Actually, yeah. But let me just say one thing. In the interest of making sure that we credit everybody, let me just show you the lab at least. This is our lab, okay? And there have been several. I mean, we've been doing a lot of different things. And there are some great guys in the lab that are working on this stuff. So first of all, there's this great graduate student in the lab, Girl Swell, right? Who Girl has this amazing ability to find the essential personality characteristic of each person in the lab and to get it down on paper. So he drew this cartoon of everyone in the lab, actually, right? And so let me just say, Alex is a great scientist, actually joined our lab from Russia. Alex was he's an amazing guy, actually. He was involved. He was actually one of the key players in Ovchinnikov's group in Russia in the 70s that sequenced rhodopsin, actually, right? So Alex has been in some very, very, he's a wonderful membrane biochemist. So Alex has done a lot of work in the biochemistry and physiology of the system. Adrian Hahn is a grad student in the lab who is doing all the ChemGuru stuff, the calcium measurements in the photoreceptor cell. Everybody else's stuff, they're doing a lot of other stuff going on, but I didn't talk about it, so that's that. And
are the collaborators going to be
my
own as well?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that we need to have, Girl needs to, he's been working very hard on some stuff and hasn't had time. And actually, he's produced one cartoon, but the thing is, I'm hesitant to show it because it's a little bit, it's a little too much. But absolutely. Kevin and Mike are absolutely going to be lampooned along with a couple of other new collaborators. So if anyone collaborates with us, it's going to be bad news. Okay. So we'll get together too.
So let's take a break till 11, 15 minute break.